not different due to skin color or whatnot. We're different because we're all human. And I don't, and I think the judgmental on anything such as crime, drug use, based on a color, where you come from, any of that. I want to see the opinions of that change. I want to see these arrest rates go down because I know that they're just focusing on the racial minority.
A change that I would like to see is this happening more than just today. It shouldn't be just the 50th anniversary celebration. We are still oppressed. There's still a lot of social issues plaguing us. It shouldn't take a 50th celebration for all of us to come together and voice these issues. This stuff needs to be taken care of every day. We should have revolutionized a long time ago.
Those are the voices of Howard University students Chelsea Davis, Teresa Moore, Deborah Samuel, Ashley Washington, and Asia Quick, Loyola University student Tita Tan, Amuche Nwafor, senior at Northwestern High School in Hyattville, Maryland, Mackenzie Williams, student at Hayfield Secondary School in Alexandria, Virginia, Tyler Goodridge, team president of the Greater New Haven Youth Council, and Avery Steck, D.C. area high school student. That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. correspondent, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Janine Etter and Rose Katapchi. Our theme music was composed and produced by Alan Weatherhead. Teddy Wilson manages our Tumblr page, where you can find sights and sounds from FSRN's global reporters. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.
Nation. WMPG is on the air thanks to listener donations and generous support from the University of Southern Maine. USM educates Maine's future artists, business people, engineers, healthcare professionals, lawyers, managers, public servants, scientists, and teachers. More information is available at usm.maine.edu.
Blunt wishes to thank the following sponsors and partners: the A.R. Gould School at Long Creek Youth Development Center, Terrascope Youth Radio at MIT, and Youth Radio from Youth Media International from Oakland, California. The views expressed on Blunt are those of the individual speakers and producers, and not those of WMPG, the University of Southern Maine, or any of Blunt's funders or supporters. Blunt Youth Radio welcomes opposing views.
Hello, and welcome to Blunt Radio.
All right, tonight on Blunt, we listen to 14 pieces from local teen writers and poets from the Portland Hive, a summer program focused on creative writing and sharing, based at the Telling Room.
That's right, and we've got so many brilliant pieces of writing and music to listen to in the next hour, we haven't got a moment to spare. So listen for names, people, because you'll want to remember the night you heard some of the most fantastic voices of our generation all in one place. I'm Anthony Lewis.
And I'm Iris Sangiovanni. The first piece is an excerpt of a narrative fiction by Colin Sharp, and he will be joining us by phone from New Orleans. So let's go ahead and listen to it.
I'm Colin Sharp, and this is an excerpt from the first chapter of a project I'm working on. It doesn't have a name yet, but hopefully it will in the future. You know, in my rather short life, I've learned a few things. Skies are generally supposed to be blue. Water is almost always supposed to be wet. And fluffy is never, ever, ever a compliment. I now submit the following knowledge to that already varied and sizable reservoir of information. 1. Wood is unforgiving to the face. And 2. Humans have absolutely no right to fly. None of this went through my mind until much later, of course, but it's my story, so I'll tell it like I want to. After unceremoniously scraping myself off the wall of Bram's wagon, I crawled up to the front, fully prepared to give him a piece of my mind. Who was he to wake me up like that? What gave him the right? There was absolutely no excuse for such an oh, he had an arrow in his shoulder. Okay, that counts as a free pass. Turning my anger forward, I looked at the horses, who also had free passes sprouting from their shoulders, legs, and stomach. I hate when there's no one for me to blame for my problems. However, such introspection and self-analysis came to an end about as quickly as our wagon came to a stop in the ditch. You know how I said people have no right to fly, right? As I fell towards the ground, I couldn't help but sigh, watching the dust cloud that meant nothing but trouble get closer and closer. Bram had been right from the beginning. Perhaps I should explain a bit. It started a few hours previously, in much the same situation, falling face first towards a hard and unforgiving surface through no fault of my own. Heck, I still don't remember how I got caught up in that freakishly large wave, tumbling towards an unidentified beach, or, well, anything else about my situation. But we'll get to that in a bit. Anyway, for all intents and purposes, just assume I didn't exist before the moment I came skipping across the sand and buried myself at Bram's feet. Now, I'm not gonna lie, I was terrified of him at first, but considering Bram all but blocked out the sun with his body, which isn't really to say that he was fat, at least not in the traditional sense. He was big in the way that those big brown animals are big, all tough and gristly. Bulls? Yeah, he was built like a bull, and he had a pitchfork, which was really freaked me out, especially when he introduced it to my back. Pitchforks, if you didn't know, are sharp. Well, wow, I never would have thought of that, Cyrus. What a riveting discovery. Jesus. You ruined the reveal. And here I thought we were on the same team, man. Well, I'm here now, jackass. Not like you're going to keep me out of your thoughts for long. Besides, the only reason you can use all these fantastic descriptions is because of my endless generosity. Guess you're right. Well, in case you didn't notice, that guy that's talking is the other voice in my head, who also gets to decide when it's necessary to share information with me. He's not to be confused with what you're listening to right now. I am the real Cyrus. Just think of me as a more awesome Cyrus. We haven't really figured out how this works yet, so I won't bog you down with the details of our situation. Alright, bro, can you hurry it up a little bit? We only get so much flashback before we hit the ground. Fine, I'll get back to it. Anyway, after Bram treated me like a hay bale for a little while, I woke up. As you do, much to his surprise. You alive, son? He asked, continuing his assault on my ribs, despite my obvious aliveness. I stood up and gave him my best, "What the heck are you doing?" look. Yeah, I'm fine, I said. He poked me again. You sure? You took a pretty hard spill there, he asked. Yeah, I'm fine, I said irritably. Who was he, my mom? What, was he my mom? I sure hope not. You don't look fine, he said, snapping me out of that particularly disturbing set of thoughts. He looked at me with squinted eyes. How'd you end up in there? Any reasonable person should know not to go swimming out there. It's dangerous. Must be some sort of tough guy or something. He poked me again. All right, stop it with the poking. I glared at him. I'm not around from here, so I don't know the water. Ah, what brings you around these parts? He asked. I opened my mouth to explain to him in no uncertain terms exactly how I'd gotten there, and this is when I realized I might have a problem. I didn't know what brought me around these parts. I didn't know much of anything at the moment.
Hi, my name is Emma Jordan.
All right. Again, that was a narrative fiction piece by Colin Sharp, and that was just a short excerpt. There's a longer excerpt, and that'll be posted to our website, bluntradio.org. And for more information about Portland Hive, go to portlandhive.org. So, Colin, what was your inspiration for the piece?
It was interesting. The piece is really something I've been working on for a long time. It's almost a year ago to this day, in fact. And the inspiration for the piece was I really wanted a character who was different. I wanted someone who really kind of changed that traditional, like, kind of fantasy hero. It is a fantasy story, but I wanted someone who was kind of funny and interesting, and Cyrus is kind of my attempt to do that.
And so, like, with Cyrus, like, he has sort of these two voices in his head that, I mean, they're pretty distinct just by hearing it, but, like, what was it like writing, you know, trying to write with these two voices, and do you feel like it adds anything to the story?
Well, yes, it definitely does add something to the story, and as you go on, the kind of nature of the two voices and the kind of arguments between them kind of grows more and more important. But it's incredibly fun to write it like that, because the best part about having two voices in the main character is that he's always got someone to talk to, and, like, there's always kind of that kind of snappy dialogue that I can have, and, like, it's almost like a crutch as a writer to have that as a device, because he's just always got another voice in his head that can kind of explain stuff and keep the narrative going if I don't have anything else to go. And he's also, the other voice is really funny, and so I loved writing him.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, like listening to it, I mean, it definitely brings sort of that comedic, detail to it, and it's enjoyable to listen to. Well, thank you, Colin, so much for sharing your piece with us. Again, that was Colin Sharp. So thanks for calling in too.
All right. It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
No problem. All right. Like Anthony was saying, we have so many pieces that we have to keep a moving.
Soon as possible.
All right. Our next piece, it's actually has multi-layered. It's by Lana Rich, and it's a excerpt of a poem. So we're gonna go ahead and listen to that.
My name is Lena Rich, and this is an excerpt from a longer poem titled The Bay. The familiar silhouette appears on the horizon. The rusty green pine trees, sharp rugged cliffs, and the comforting roofline of the big house. My mother hands me the binoculars and whispers in my ear, "Can you see it?" The mid-afternoon sun glimmers on the tinted water, the clouds, a plush catastrophe, recovering from an early morning thunderstorm.
My name is Maddie Pierce, and I'll be reading an excerpt from a fiction piece that I'm currently working on in first-person narrative.
And again, that was the excerpt of a poem by Lana Rich. And one of the, there were some phrases that sort of stuck out in my mind. And I kind of like poems because, they describe a picture in just so few words. So, like, rusty green, like, tinted water, and plush catastrophe were some things that, like, stood out.
Plush catastrophe really is one of those, as a phrase in and of itself kind of stands up there with, like, some of the finest writing I've ever heard. Plush catastrophe just kind of blows me away. Very well.
All right, and if you liked that, you're going to like what's up next. We have more from Lena Rich. She wrote five haiku poems. So let's go ahead and listen to that.
In the pool, limp and drifting, a mouse. From under the dock, the spiders emerge to escape the wake. If I could only find the notes to match the moonshine. Under a log, still and damp, a spotted salamander. Wrinkly lips, pursed, waiting for a kiss.
All right, and again, that was Lena Rich. And all of these pieces, again, are going to be uploaded to our website, bluntradio.org. So check it out. I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
And I am Anthony Lewis.
And now in studio with us, we have Maddie Pierce. And we're going to be listening to it's an excerpt of a fiction piece. And then we'll be talking about it with her. So let's go ahead and listen to it.
My name is Maddie Pierce, and I'll be reading an excerpt from a fiction piece that I'm currently working on in first-person narrative. His lips were pale blue. The chill of the evening air did not escape the hallowed hall he had stepped into as a means to evade the harsh winter air. Bones fragile and breaking beneath the weight of his lofty uniform, he deigned to step from the warm security of his coat and greet the world of my Cincinnati. I felt drawn to him, wanting to breathe the same air that filled his delicate lungs. It was his eyes, a dark, penetrating blue that stuck like a knife to the heart. I wasn't the easiest person to be swayed, but something about his demeanor set my heart fluttering. The war had ended several years ago, but he wore his uniform like a purple heart, signifying to the world that he was a man whose defining experience lay in a past life of courage and valor. This pride grasped his hollow cheeks, which were drawn tautly around his elongated face. He glanced in my direction and just as subtly looked away. He had no intentions of making acquaintances, so it seemed. The snow that clung to his hair dripped without consequence, pooling on the scratched wooden floorboards and reflecting the dim lights that hung harshly from the ceiling. He moved towards me, looking beyond to the smoke-filled parlor, where the lonely and the daring sulked in all their splendor. He coughed hesitantly into the crook of his arm, indicating to me that he did not join in the communal smoking that occurred at such events, but rather kept to his senses and preserved his overwrought lungs. With an air of uninhibited confidence, he stepped to stand by my side, paying me no particular attention, but looking at the crowd gathered with disapproval and scorn. His neck bore a scar that stretched from the tip of his right ear to just along his Adam's apple. It stood starkly in red, burning with a passion that could not be quelled by any natural means of healing. As I stared, my fingers began to intertwine with his until they overwhelmed my feeble hand. He looked at me with those penetrating blue eyes, and before I knew it, the snow was falling around us as he glided like a swan upon the water through the streets of Cincinnati, pausing under the street lamps to reacquaint himself with his surroundings. We ambled towards a quaint cafe perched on the corner of a cobblestone street. A flickering coffee sign greeted us with hesitation. Like any gentleman, he opened the heavy door to permit my entry. Yet rather than watching for my safe passage, his attention was beheld by a soiree occurring inside of another bar across the road. The laughter of partygoers died away as we seated ourselves at a table adjacent to the counter. An old man of feeble stature slumped on a wooden chair to our right, giving no indication that he was aware of our arrival. The waitress took her time getting to our table, obviously irked by our impromptu interruption. I watched her sway back and forth as she began placing our order, her movements awkward and strained. By the time my eyes had returned to my companion, I found his penetrating eyes gazing back at me. Goosebumps ran up and down my body, making my dark hair stand starkly out against the pallor of my skin. My heart, already on edge, shattered when a crackled voice rose from his being, awakening something inside of me that yearned to be released. I've missed you.
Again, that was just a short excerpt by Maddie Pierce, and a longer excerpt can be found on our website. It'll be uploaded, bluntradio.org. So, Maddie, this was really short, so, I mean, just give us a little bit more insight to, like, the relationship between the character and the man, you know?
Well, I first started with this character back in my AP literature class this past year, where the teacher assigned us to really go in hyper detail about a character and not to be within them, but to observe them from another person's point of view. And I went back and looked at this assignment during the Hive week because I was kind of confused about what kind of writing piece I wanted to continue. And I saw this relationship between the two characters that I really loved and wanted to pursue. And it's a romantic relationship, but in this first scene that you saw, it's a feeling that they haven't seen each other before, but then you get this essence that they've had this long, drawn-out past by him saying that, "I've missed you." So I just feel like when I wrote it, I left a lot of room for continuing the piece, and I really wanted to develop the relationship between the two.
Mm-hmm. And like you were talking about, you know, the detail, the fragile bones, the delicate lungs, like, you know, the descriptions are, some of them are, you know, come off as delicate. Was that, you know, sort of intentional at all, or?
Yeah, definitely. I love the use of, like, really rich detail. It's both a blessing and a curse in my writing. Sometimes I go overboard with it, but I wanted the sense that he was both physically and emotionally a distraught man that had gone through a lot, so that I'd have the ability to really build upon their relationship and show how she had improved him, but then the war and their separation from one another really degraded him in all ways, so.
So a couple times you mentioned the war and that he's a military man, and it's a lot of what you talk about him being a gentleman seems very sort of old fashioned to me. Is this meant to take place in another time period or another era?
Yes, it was. The assignment given by my teacher was surrounding the Great Gatsby, so it was supposed to be set in that time period, which sort of inspired the whole soldier uniform and past. The setting of Cincinnati was kind of random, but the past setting, it would be somewhere, I'm thinking, in the 40s or 50s. So,
well, thank you, Maddie Pierce, for joining us and sharing your piece. But we have lots more to hear, so we're going to be moving on. Our next piece is a perspective on the royal birth in a form of a ransom note. So, again, not to be taken seriously, but it is written by Emma Jordan. So let's go ahead and listen to it. And when we get back, we're going to be speaking with Anthony Emerson and Gabby Gaspaldi in studio. So stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Emma Jordan. I'm going to be reading a perspective on the royal birth in the form of a ransom note.
Attention, royal family. If you are wondering why you have not been allowed to see your new son yet, it is because he is not in the hospital. He is with us. However, he will be returned to the hospital, and his date of birth changed to the day we give him back, if we receive a cash payment of 500 million pounds. This money must be divided into 16 separate envelopes and left at each of the addresses listed on the back of this paper at 11 p.m. on July 21st. You will find none of us at these locations. You must not mention this note or its contents to anyone or inform anyone that the baby is missing. In fact, you would be wise to pretend he has not yet been born, as nobody yet knows of his birth besides you, us, and five hospital workers, who we guarantee will not let anything slip. If you do not comply or mention this note, your baby will perish. We urge you to consider your child's safety and your own safety in the aftermath of any scandal you might bring upon yourselves by ignoring this message. Do not attempt to contact us. We await your payment.
No. And you are back. Again, that was a piece, a ransom note, not to be taken real again, by Emma Jordan. So thank you, Emma. And again, all of these pieces are going to be uploaded to our website, bluntradio.org. And if you want to learn more information about Portland Hive, portlandhive.org. I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
I am Anthony Lewis.
And in studio now, we have a couple of more writers with us. We have Anthony Emerson and Gabby Gaspaldi. We're going to be first listening to Anthony Emerson's piece. Although before we do, I just want to say that the content of this narrative, Zero Day, which is it's titled, contains sexual assault and school gun violence. So it's not appropriate for young children or people who are sensitive to the topics. So I just want to put that out there as a trigger warning, just so you're prepared as we listen to it. Again, this is by Anthony Emerson, and it is titled Zero Day. Let's go ahead and listen to it.
My name is Anthony Emerson. I graduated from Deering High School this past June. Yeah, my piece is called Zero Day. It's an excerpt. It's kind of violent, so sorry. May the 14th, one day before, 11:29 p.m. I hate writing about dreams. I also hate listening to people talk about their dreams, because they're boring, usually. But I just had a dream. It was one of those memories within a dream things. I was in a boat on a pond, or maybe it was a small lake, as if there's any meaningful difference between those two. Maybe small lakes are deeper than ponds? And I was with my grandfather. I hadn't seen my grandfather since I was 6 years old, because he died when I was 6 years old. Anyway, my grandfather and I were fishing out of the small boat thing, and he was laughing, and I was laughing, and we were having a good time because we were laughing. I mean, we wouldn't be laughing if we were having a bad time, would we? The dream changed from the boat on a pond to my dining room. I was sitting, and my parents were sitting across from me. My feet couldn't quite hit the floor below me. They were telling me something sad because I was crying and my mother was crying. The dream changed from my dining room to a church. I was sitting in the front row. My mother was crying. An older gentleman with one of those army beret hats was talking about my grandfather's service in Korea. He was crying. So then I woke up. I hadn't thought about my grandfather's death in forever. Why was it flooding back to me now? I can't help but think that this is a bad omen. May the 15th, 0 days, 9 hours before, 2:48 a.m. These have to be omens. I had another nightmare. I was back behind the gym to score some weed for the first time in my life. I heard screaming and I stopped dead in my tracks, put my body flush against the brick wall and peered over the corner. Two football players had a younger girl down on the ground. I stopped looking, praying to a god I didn't believe in that what I just witnessed wasn't happening. I looked back over. The girl's top was off now, and the two football players were pawing at her breasts. I recognized the football players now as guys whom I'd known, whom I'd consider almost friends. I didn't recognize the girl. "Please no," she screamed. "Shut up. You know you want this," one of them snarled. "Yeah, you know how many girls want to get with us? Well, it's your lucky day. You're getting both of us." I was numb and frozen. I couldn't believe what I was seeing, what I was hearing. Every fiber of my being wanted to run and tell someone to prevent this. but instead I turned around and walked home, calling the school to say I had left during lunch because of an illness. I never told anybody. Because I still see those two guys daily. I'm assuming she never did, either. Edmund Burke is screaming at me in my head. For once, I think that right-wing bastard was right. He has been ever since I saw that sophomore year. I may have done nothing, but I never said I was a good man. As if that's an excuse. May the 15th, 0 days, 2 hours before, 9:11 a.m. I told Jamie about the first nightmare. I'm embarrassed about the second because I figure she'll figure out that I had witnessed a rape and never told anybody, and that basically makes me an accessory. She said she hated hearing about other people's dreams. I said, yeah, me too, but I can't help but feeling like this is a bad omen or something. Technically, there are no good omens. An omen, by definition, is bad. You've been spending way too much time with me. I laughed. She shot me that smile that made everything seem like it'd be okay, even when it wasn't. May the 15th, 0 days, 0 hours, and 33 minutes before, 10:56 a.m. We got our senior year schedules today. I got AP History with Jamie and the other Sam, with Mr. Chamberlain. That should be good. James is an awesome teacher. Jamie had decided, erroneously in my opinion, to take AP English with Mrs. Fabregas, or as I like to call her, effing ass, whom we had sophomore year together. She's an awful teacher, an overcritical, condescending bully. I guess AP credits mean just that much to her. The other Sam, Kennedy, and I teased her about it. Jamie and I went to lunch. May the 15th, 0 days, 0 hours, 0 minutes before, 11:29 a.m. The first gunshots sounded close and far at the same time. I had heard them, but they didn't register initially. Then I heard the screams and more shots. A stampede of humanity rushed up from the central stairwell. People crying, screaming. I saw one person, a freshman I had surveyed during history class, covered in blood. She was being carried by an older football player. Please, no! Another shot rang out. At this time, I was certain I knew what was going on. I just didn't really believe it. I looked at Jamie. All the color had left her face. Internally, I was panicking. Externally, I was moving slowly and methodically. To this day, I wonder why I didn't book it for the east stairwell, which had a direct exit. For whatever reason, Jamie was still next to me. At this point, I'd reached the central stairwell. I looked down and saw the first dead body. I saw some people still alive but mortally wounded. One made eye contact with me. Her eyes screamed for me to help her. I was frozen. I heard Jamie gasp, then gag next to me. I recognized one of the wounded. She was in third grade for me. Her name was Marianne Chernikov, a fourth-generation immigrant from Belarus. She had been quiet and studious. Few friends. I don't remember ever speaking to her. At that moment, I had decided to rescue her. At that moment, a bullet ripped into her skull. I hadn't even heard the first gunshot. Jamie was acting on instinct now. She grabbed my hand and screamed, "We have to go, now." I couldn't really believe what was happening. As I was sprinting down the second-floor hallway, I remember that I had talked to Marianne Chernikov back in the third grade. She had one of those big boxes of Crayola crayons, the ones that held 64 crayons and usually would make the person who owned them the most popular person in class. But not in her case. Marianne Chernikov wasn't so lucky, I guess. I'd asked her for a blue crayon. She had given it to me. I had said thanks.
All right. Again, that piece, 0 Day, was written by Anthony Emerson. And I just want to put it out there that, you know, Blunt Radio doesn't endorse any of these types, you know, of actions that took place during the piece. And, I mean, it really is an intense piece. But I do want to put it out there also that all of these pieces will be uploaded to our website, bluntradio.org.
So, Anthony, when you reference Edmund Burke at one point, mm-hmm. We were sort of assuming that you're referencing the famous quote that's attributed to Edmund Burke, "The only thing necessary for evil to triumph is for good men to do nothing."
Yes.
So, I mean, what made you decide to put that in your piece? Like, how did that come to mind for you?
I was in the hive, you know, I was just writing on instinct, and, I was just trying to think of ways to get this character to appear human and flawed, and, like, he's made a bunch of mistakes in his life, but he regrets them, and he's, like, he really regrets them, actually, and that's basically his driving force throughout the entire piece, because, you know, he witnesses this one thing and he never does anything about it. And, you know, that haunts him for the rest of his life. He can't even tell anyone about it. And so then he witnesses this other awful thing and, you know, how it's going to change him. And, yeah.
Actually, sort of going off of that, the main character of this piece witnesses a, sexual assault, mm-hmm. and that he stays silent for, mm-hmm. but later in the piece, the character then attempts to save a girl who's fallen victim exactly. to gun violence. And is that some way, the evolution of the character?
Yeah.
And, how do the two events connect?
No, I can understand how, the second dream could seem kind of out of place, but that was definitely, supposed to be parallel, witnessing Marianne getting killed, he wanted to save her, and again, he doesn't do it, so how's this going to change him,
And one last question before we go to break, but, mm-hmm. Why... when writing from such perspectives mm-hmm. as you did, any research went into this, or the writing process, was that like?
Not as much as one would think. It's probably really morbid, but I looked up the firearms used in the Columbine massacre, and I used similar ones for the characters, which isn't referenced in the. In the excerpt that you played here, but later on in the piece is. So, but yeah, I didn't look up survivor stories or writing about it, because I wanted to be original, and I didn't want to be
But do you feel like you're sort of reinforcing those stereotypes of how, victims and gun violence and mm-hmm. sexual assault, how that all unfolds? Do you feel like... where am I going?
Where are you going?
Were you trying to sort of reinforce the stereotypical reactions to such? Or this is just what came to mind?
Yeah, this is just what came to mind. And later on the piece, it becomes more about Jamie and Sam's relationship. How it's affected, and because of this, and my mentor at the Hive, Taryn Bowe, said that's what she wanted to keep reading, so that's what I kept writing, and that's what I'm still writing about Sam and Jamie's relationship. And so it's not so much about the violence or even the shooting, really. It's about these two people who experience a horrible thing, and will they find solace in each other, or will they remind each other of the event? So,
all right. Well, thank you very much, Anthony Emerson. Yeah. We do have to go to break, but stay tuned because we have so much more in store. We'll be hearing from Gabby Gaspaldi. We have a live musician. I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
I am Anthony Lewis.
This is Blunt Radio with our guest, Portland Hive. So please stay tuned. And
Our break music is going to be... provided by Lindsay Lombardi. She is an 18-year-old singer-songwriter from the greater Portland area, and she's written a song called Sorry. She attends Portland Arts and Technology High School, and she's been there for the past 3 years, where she recorded her original song. And we're going to play that for break music for you today. She's going to be pursuing music at USM this fall. So let's go ahead, go to break, and make sure to keep your ears wide open for Lindsay.
Well, I'm
here's the weather for tonight. A 20% chance of showers after 3 a.m., mostly cloudy, with a low around 62, southwest wind 5 to 10 miles per hour, becoming light in the evening. Tomorrow it's going to be sunny, high near 77, calm wind, and then Wednesday it's going to be thunderstorms after 11 a.m.
You're listening to WMPG and W281AC Gorham Portland, Southern Maine Community Radio from the University of Southern Maine.
All right, and again, that was Lindsay Lombardi, and that was her original piece of work, Sorry. And to get more of Lindsay Lombardi's songs, you know, stay informed about what's going on, check out her Facebook page. It's facebook.com/LindsayLombardiMusic, and we will put a link to that on our website, bluntradio.org. So thank you, Lindsay. You know, local musicians. We have local poets and writers from Portland Hive. This is Blunt Youth Radio. I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
And I'm Anthony Lewis.
All right. And in studio, we have Gabby Gaspardi. And she wrote a piece, a short story, on Thoughts of a Commuter. So without further ado, we are going to listen to that.
My name is Gabby Gaspardi, and this is my short story called Thoughts of a Commuter. He walks down the crowded sidewalk, hundreds of people packed together and spanning to the horizon, the stoic face worn by him, being passed on to others. A short man pushes his way through the crowd, his face stressed in red. A woman in a short dress, looking bright and cheery, jauntily waltzes through the crowd. He sees these people. He sees their lives and emotions painted brightly on their faces. He thinks, can these people see my story? Do they see my feelings? Do they see the depressed businessman who lives alone in a one-bedroom apartment? Or do they just see a statue in a suit? His stoic face is interrupted by the biting of his lower lip. Where do all these people go? Do they go to the same places as me? He walks down the dark gray cement stairs leading to the subway station. He sits on an orange-colored plastic seat in need of a new paint job and looks across the car. The reflection of him in his navy suit and dark red tie projects on the window. A red tie? He looks down at his navy suit with a green tie. Again, he looks across the car. The reflection across is not a reflection at all. It is another man with the same stoic face, but with the too familiar look of yearning for a different life pouring from the man's eyes. Does this man share my story? Does this man share my feelings? He thinks. He closes his eyes and leans his head back on the window. He hears the subway clicking. A woman sitting next to him turning the pages of a dull book, and the rustle of a newspaper in the distance. All the noises of the subway drifting away as he slowly imagines himself in a small house on the beach. The waves lapping against the shore, and birds flying over his house, singing as they go by. To be away from everyone, in seclusion, never again to go on a noisy subway. Never again having to push my way through the crowded street. Never again would I have to wear a navy suit with a dark green tie. The screeching of the subway and the muffled voice of the driver announcing the destination brings him back to the orange plastic seat and his navy suit with the dark green tie. He opens his eyes and slowly gets up to walk to the platform, the swarm of people consuming every inch of his space, all bustle and hurry, to get to the dark gray cement stairs leading back up to the real world first. He makes his way through the crowd and mounts the stairs leading up. Too soon, he is thrust back into the world he tried to escape. Again, he walks down the crowded sidewalk with hundreds of people, all packed together, spanning to the horizon. He walks two long blocks before he reaches the structure where every day he sits at the same desk with the same fake plant next to him. He reaches his building and looks up. The dark, ominous building glares down at him, as if it was a self-portrait of the boss himself. He unwillingly walks up the cement stairs and opens the immaculately clean glass doors. He walks into the elevator with 8 other employees and stands in silence with the rest of them. The elevator, slow, slides its metallic doors open to floor 21. He looks out at the sea of cubicles, all occupied with men hunched over, mechanically typing away their lives. He reaches his desk and sits down in the cold plastic office chair he bought at a discount. He looks out the window once more, before he starts typing his life away. One day, he thought, someone will share my story.
I'm Jessica Keast, and this is my poem. Nothing...
Sorry about that. That was a poem from, Gabby Gaspardi, Thoughts of a Commuter. It was a short I'm sorry, it wasn't a poem at all. It was a short story. Completely my fault.
And I hope you've been writing down these names, people, because, I mean, these are young writers and musicians in your community. They're going to be famous one day, and you want to be able to say you knew them. You heard them on Blunt Radio.
Yeah, when they were just up-and-comers. You can tell your grandchildren.
Yes. So, Gabby Gaspardi. So this is about, you know, a businessman. You know, how do you think, like, the portrayal of this business character reflects on your, you know, personal feelings of the business world / if at all?
Well, it's kind of like, I see all businessmen as sort of like a suit. I don't know. I don't really know one, so I can't really say that they have personalities yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I guess until you know them.
Yeah, but like, I mean, like, from what I took from it, I mean, like, this businessman in the suit, as you said, is just really wishing for another life, and it just seems really sad. And
yeah.
Like, and it, I mean, it's kind of how I view the business world, and perhaps others do as well. But like, what was your like inspiration for this piece?
I don't really know, actually. I just kind of wrote it. And, yeah.
Like, for me, like, well, listening to it, like, I kind of, just because it is, like, a businessman, it kind of reminded me of the Death of a Salesman. Like, you know, like, that play. Well, I mean, obviously, like, a shorter version that sort of narrows in on, like, a particular scene of the business world. But, yeah, I liked it. And I know it didn't... Anthony, your thoughts.
My thoughts, yes, sure. Well, I mean, I thought it was a pretty accurate portrayal. I don't personally know too many businessmen, you know, apart from my father, who, you know, I guess I'm partial in some ways towards him. But for the most part, I think the businessmen that I see tend to be sort of just dreary, drab suits. Like you said, it kind of just meander through the day going about their usual business. And I mean, do you think that you said that you don't know any businessmen, so it's hard to judge them on their, you know, their personalities before you know them. But do you think that the profession, sort of a boring desk job like that, do you think someone's personality lends itself to a job like that? Or do you think it's sort of just someone's personality and someone's work can be two disparate things?
I think they could be two different things, because, like, the whole weekend warrior situation, and then you just go back to your cubicle, I guess.
Fair enough.
Great. And again, if you want to listen to Gabby Gaspardi's piece, all the pieces from Portland Hive tonight, check out our website, bluntradio.org. All right, so we have more in store.
We do have more in store. We have actually a very special treat for you listeners. We have a live musician with us. Andrew Hunter is a local musician from South Portland who is also studying business management at USM. His former band was Saint Monday, but now Andrew is playing as a solo artist. So, without further ado, we'll be talking to him after he plays a song. Here is Andrew Hunter performing Sunrise.
Can you feel it? Morning lights, I've never seen it rise up so high. I know that you could say goodbye so easily. And I know that with the next sunrise, won't feel the same. Can you hear it in the whispering tides? Get off the phone now. It's time to say goodbye. And I know that it's my own mistake. I can see it high up in the sky above. Just all feels the same. No place to be, no people I know. I'm on the run. Soon it's near the moonlight, dear. It's far away. You believe it? Been waiting so long. Baby, I need it to go on. And this fear is just one step away. The sun may not rise today. It all feels the same. No place to be, no people I know. I'm on the run. Soon it's near the moonlight, dear. It's far away. That's far away.
All right. Well done, Andrew.
Thanks.
So I know this is a question that no one can really answer, but where have you drawn inspiration in the past? Like, what's your writing process?
Well, I guess my writing process, I always start off with the chords for the guitar. That's where I like to start. And, you know, the words are actually something that come last for me. It's always the chords and then a melody. And, you know, and recordings, harmonies and everything. But the words really... I mean, I know words are important, but, you know, I feel like the emotions that you can get through the music is really my inspiration.
That's interesting. It's often the opposite for a lot of people. That's great. So do you have any advice maybe for aspiring writers or musicians younger than yourself who, you know?
You know, just do it, I guess. I went through, I guess, a phase, you know, towards the end of high school, senioritis kicked in. Mm-hmm. You know, with everything. It wasn't just school. You know, I stopped playing music as much. And just do it. Don't stop, you know. If you keep doing it, you're going to get somewhere somehow.
All right. Well, Andrew
Hunter.
Great.
Well, thank you, Andrew Hunter.
Yeah,
he's a friend, so I'm glad to have you on. And I think that's to be said with everyone here tonight, just all the writers, poets, musicians that we've heard. You know, I want them to continue, and I hope listeners also are encouraged to do the same. I'm Iris Sangiovanni.
I'm Anthony Lewis, and we're going to get moving right along here. Cause
we have plenty of more to play. We're going to be listening to a memoir, an excerpt of a memoir by Morgan Elkins.
I'm Morgan Elkins, and the piece that I'm going to be reading is called Cold House, and it's a memoir that I wrote. Leaning against the blue pantry door, wooden ridges digging into my spine, I fiddled with my laptop. Double-clicked Safari and waited for the comforting sight of Pandora Radio to flood my screen. My fingers twitched, pressing the volume until all 16 gray boxes were filled with white and my headphones were ringing with static. The Rolling Stones and Modest Mouse clouded over my eyes, and I let out a breath I hadn't known I had been holding. The air was cold and stiff. I stared at the floor. A spider crawled across the slate tiles, dipping into a crack like a trench. I waited for it to reappear, but all that seemed to happen was the cobwebs holding me quiet crept and grew. I turned my head. Parker sat with his back to me, bent over a novel. He seemed lost in his own world until his shoulders hunched when their voices raised. You hear in stories how, when parents fought, their voices grew lower and lower, and that was what scared the kids the most. How serious discussions meant ears pressed to closed doors and whispered breaths. I can't imagine why anyone would ever try to hear. My aunt and uncle's house was built with arching beams and murmur-thin walls. My brother shook with their voices' vibrations, and I knew that I had to do something. As I watched, his silhouette turned and his eyes met mine. Watching Pirates of the Caribbean together wasn't the best plan I'd ever devised. The on-screen laughter did nothing to mask the walls of the cold house where I crouched, trying to block the sound of them and shove the psych wards and medical bills and identity theft into a cardboard box and burn it. Praying like crazy to find a pirate who would stab the shadows and fight the monster under his bed so he could close his eyes and maybe get some sleep at night. Swords clashed and sparks of metal flew off the screen and landed in my brother's hair. I watched him as he watched the actors pretending some fairy tale like everything would work out. With one earbud hidden behind my hair and the other snaking to Parker, I wasn't deaf anymore. I didn't feel safe, didn't feel empty. I could hear them as they whispered words like curses. Penn Bay, Maine Medical, Boston. Locked up, tucked away, institutionalized. Better for everyone. So I turned my face away and pressed my fist against my empty ear and pretended to prop my head as I tried not to hear. Parker's eyes lit up and shone as Johnny Depp lunged, shifting his sword into flesh. He mouthed the words that he knew by then by heart. We watched the film again and again until my back ached from sitting too long and my feet and hands and brain were frozen. Their voices never faded. And when Parker looked over at me so many scenes later, I realized the sparks hidden in his eyes were tears. He whispered, "Is it going to be okay, Morgan?" And I didn't know what to tell him. I squeezed his hand. He let me hold it for a beat longer than he normally would have. Then he slipped it from my palm, turning back to the movie resting on our knees. I bit my tongue, wishing he didn't hear them, wishing I could give him a reason to pretend to act his age. My little brother didn't need to know this, didn't need to hear the harsh, bleak details of mental illness, didn't need to listen to them through paper-thin walls, hear his mother cry and his uncle's voice shake and deny. I don't know what I could have done. It wasn't like there was sanctuary anywhere. For months, we drifted around our house with iPods welded to our hands, earphones melted to skin. Distant satellites colliding in the bathroom in the mornings to splash water on our faces, drag a brush through our hair, go to school, and pretend like everything was fine.
All right, again, that was Morgan Elkins, and you can find the piece bluntradio.org. Up next,
we've got Malachi Witten reading a historical fiction piece about Ukrainian genocide.
Hello, my name is Malachi DeCorwin, and this is my historical fiction piece on the Ukrainian famine. Chapter 1, The Skeleton. January 7th, 1932. She wasn't awake. No, it was too early for her. But still, I stood there, examining her, seeing how much she's altered. Grandma used to be big-bellied, always smiling, enough meat on her bone to be mistaken for an ox. She used to be fat, but that was a while ago, before the genocide among my people. Her ribs look as if they are trying to burst out of her stomach. What stomach? She barely had one. Imagine a skeleton with just enough skin to wrap around its bones. Now imagine that skeleton with short gray hair, a long nose, and a permanent frown. Imagine that, and you've got my grandma. She was skinny. I could feel a cold liquid escaping from my eyes and sprinting down my cheeks, running away from my body. The skeleton turned in its bed, its eyes staring straight into my soul. This is the first time I've seen her like this. I haven't been home since 1929. I realized I was wrong. The frown wasn't permanent, because she smiled. All I wanted this year was to see my grandmother again. Well, I got my wish. It's as if God is playing a cruel, sick joke on me. I managed to smile back as I said, "Merry Christmas." I secured her down the stairs. Although there were only 7 steps, it felt like millions. Each step she took, a faint cry of pain would slip from her dry mouth. This took several minutes to do a task that's a matter of seconds.
And that was Malachi Witten reading his historical fiction piece about the Ukrainian genocide. If you want to hear the rest of that piece, you can go to our website at bluntradio.org. We had to cut it because we have not a lot of time and we want to get to our next piece.
All right, next piece. Sarah Heath, a poem about content called Contentness.
20 times smaller.
My name is Sarah Heath, and this poem is called Contentness. Children running along a forgotten dirt road. Why are they so happy? Hands clasped together, praying for a way out. Where are they trapped in? A woman lying on a bed, her mind shut off from the world. What is she thinking about? Feet digging into the soil, a guitar draped lazily over their legs. When will they start playing? Patterns erupting in all of these heads, shapes glowing and overlapping one another. Textures and soft clouds, drifting in all directions. Something brushes against their clothing. A question. What are you going to do to save yourself? What is there to save, think the children. We are happy. What is there to save, think the hands. We are together. What is there to save, thinks the woman. I am peaceful. What is there to save, think the feet. We are comfortable. Contentness brings all of these together, just like you and your imagination.
All right. Thank you, Sarah Heath. And up next is Teo Dean with a poem called Page Monster.
My name is Teo Dean. This is Page Monster, and it's a poem. There is nothing scarier than a blank page. It stares at me, and I, it. Don't blink, I think. Don't let it smell your fear. Fingers drumming restlessly, mind wandering. I can feel the page sneer. There's a little buzz in the back of my mind, song lyrics running in circles. All the single ladies, all the single ladies. The scratch of pencils surround me, but what is there to write? What is there to say that hasn't already been said? The page is laughing now. It mocks me. I pick up my pencil and wield it like a sword. I will not be defeated by this blank monster. I strike the sheet, leaving mark after mark. Not laughing anymore, now are you, page? I cut and I slash, leaving marks maliciously. You fiend, I think. You were a worthy opponent, and in other circumstances might have proved a valuable ally. But no matter, you chose to be my enemy, and now you must die. I write until there's barely any white space left. I stare again at a blank page. My fingers drum restlessly. I prepare for battle.
And that was Teo Dean reading Page Monster. Next up, we have Maryam Jabbar reading a short story.
The guy had a pink hoodie, blue jeans, and black gun. I think he was wearing the pink hoodie, so people thought he was a girl when he went in to rob the gas station. It was a dark night, without even one star shining in the sky. The guy walked in, looking around until the gas station was empty. Then he pulled out his gun and pointed it at Jeremy, who was the cashier. He was so scared, he looked like he was choking. I was recently hired to stock up the fridge in the back of the store. When I saw the guy pointing the gun at Jeremy, I didn't know what to do. I snuck up carefully behind his back, picked up a can of beans from one of the shelves, and hit him in the back of his head. Then he passed out, and I called the cops. I looked down at the body on the floor. I was scared that he would wake up before the cops arrived. Jeremy was still in shock. When the cops came, they took the guy away. A criminal deserves a punishment, and his was jail. Everyone was proud of me, everyone except me.
All right, and that was Maryam Jabbar. Up next is a poem by Jessica Keast called Silence.
I'm Jessica Keast, and this is my poem. Nothing is as loud as silence. Nothing. Not blaring music from another car's speakers. Not the siren of a passing ambulance. Not the banging on piano keys when you are trying to sleep. Mind you, it needs to be an absolute silence. No twittering birds. No monotonous AC. No white noise whatsoever. This silence, it begins to scare you. Consume you. Makes you afraid to breathe. Breath is sound. You begin to feel your heart. ba-boom, ba-boom. The pulse is not in your chest, but in your ears. And then you can hear it. It feels like the silence is in your heartbeat. You wish it would stop. The noise, the lack of noise. It becomes louder and louder. And all you can think about is the beating and the quiet.
And that was Jessica Keast reading her poem. The two poems we did, or the two writings we were not able to get to, was Maggie Brescia, who was responding to a music quote, and Kiernan Cummings with a short story called Cutting Grass. If you want to hear either of those or any of the other ones that were read today, they will be on bluntradio.org.
And we want to thank Portland Hive. Thank you. And for more information about them, portlandhive.org.
I am Anthony Lewis.
And I'm Ira San Giovanni. Thank you to our engineers, Ava Zwinski, Leo Hilton.
Matt
thank
Osmond.
You. Thank you, and good night.
And next up will be jazz.
Chapter 1. He adored New York City. He idolized it all out of proportion. He romanticized it all out of proportion. Better. To him, no matter what the season was, this was still a town that existed in black and white and pulsated to the great tunes of George Gershwin. Now, let me start this over. Chapter 1. He was too romantic about Manhattan, as he was about everything else. He thrived on the hustle bustle of the crowds and the traffic. To him, New York meant beautiful women and street-smart guys who seemed to know all the angles. Corny, too corny for a man of my taste. let me try and make it more profound. Chapter 1. He adored New York City. To him, it was a metaphor for the decay of contemporary culture. The same lack of individual integrity that caused so many people to take the easy way out was rapidly turning the town of his dreams and... Now, it's going to be too preachy. I mean, you know, let's face it, I want to sell some books here. Chapter 1. He adored New York City, although to him it was a metaphor for the decay of contemporary culture. How hard it was to exist in a society desensitized by drugs, loud music, television, crime, garbage. Too angry. I don't want to be angry. Chapter 1. He was as tough and romantic as the city he loved. Behind his black-rimmed glasses was the coiled sexual power of a jungle cat. Oh, I love this. New York was his town, and it always would be.